and welcome to Worlds Apart. Identity politics has long been American politicians' preferred way of deflecting from the real issues at home, but abroad it's been used as a powerful tool to deliberately sow chaos and ensure American influence. Why does turning neighbors against each other still work, despite all the records of destruction and bloodshed associated with it? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Anuradha Chinoy, a professor emerita at Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. Professor Chinoy, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, we hear a lot about American identity politics in the domestic political context, but you are one of the few academics who is studying how these divide and conquer tactics are used internationally. And there is nothing new or sophisticated about them. I mean, they date back to Roman times and perhaps even earlier. Why do you think, though, the Americans never fail to find new client states or new client groups to maintain this modus operandi despite all the, you know, sorry record that it's associated with?
Well, the reason is that, of course, all societies have, different power groups, factions, competition for power, divisions on the basis of religion, language, identity. But what the U.S. does, it fuses itself into any conflict. So when the root causes could be anything, they are ready, fused, because they have their links in society, in civil society, within political groups, because of their money and surveillance and advanced technology. So they are already fused in. So whenever the opportunity arises, they take the side which is coincides with their interests, the side which is going to support them.
You know, we have a saying here in Russia that the only thing history teaches us is that it teaches no lessons. And yet we all, ordinary people, I mean, we all want to think of national elites as people who usually have some education, some historical and geopolitical perspective, and hopefully that's the most crucial thing, some allegiance to their country and their people. They may have some Western grooming, sure, but by and large, people who come to power usually promise to deliver something to their constituents. And what I want to ask you is, where do they usually get tripped? What are some of the soft or weak spots that the West is most likely to exploit?
Firstly, the political elites have a lot bigger stake in holding on to power than normal people. So they forget ethics, and their loyalty is all usually, especially in smaller, weaker states, first to themselves, then their party, and then last to the country, and fourth last to the people. So the Americans know that because they study these very carefully. They have hundreds of think tanks looking at each country, at individuals. I think they have lists of people in all these countries who could go with them, especially amongst the elites. And they work, have a long-term vision, and they work with these groups in different ways for a long time. You asked about the weaknesses. Is a fact that identity politics remains for a long time, and local language politics, religious politics. You can see that in so many states where very often minorities are oppressed, or if one group holds power, then the Americans, they also use a hybrid kind of ways. Their wars and their interventions are hybrid. They could be economic, they can be carrot and stick, and they can be force, and they can be, all kinds of surveillance they have on people. We've seen that in the Philippines, for example. I'm taking a name of how they have interests with one elite, etc. So they have multiple kind of, they know the weak spots of leaders.
Mm-hmm. And they surely used all those multiple tools in the context of the conflict in Ukraine. I know that you're a specialist on Central Asia and on Russian studies as well. And I've heard you say that you are shocked that some former Soviet republics like Moldova, or to a lesser extent Georgia, would still be interested in being affiliated with NATO after seeing what happened to Ukraine and what is still happening to Ukraine. What's so unbelievable? What's so shocking to you about that?
Well, one, what's shocking is the fact that they get taken up by being European. Even if they become European, they'll be rejected or they'll be second and third tier. So this whole idea that, you know, the Georgians or the Moldavians will become European, one. Second, then they oppress the minorities, the Russian language speakers. Like in the Baltics, they had a constitution where they suddenly said, after all these years, that you can't speak Russian language like they did in Ukraine. So whole groups get disaffected. And then the elite links up with the US. That's what they're waiting for, you know, this disaffection and these potential civil wars. And they don't apply this to the fact that, you know, how terrible it is in Ukraine and how the country is demolished and who is going to put it together, who is buying up all the land, who is, you know, the contracts have already gone to BlackRock and various corporates. So the dots, there's so much flow of, you know, consumer information that the real dots remain unconnected. You can see that with the media, with the hegemonic media, with the hegemonic press, the mainstream, and any alternate gets banned or sidelined.
Now, if you look at that from a cost-benefit analysis, as well as through the prism of all the challenges that are facing the world, isn't it also shocking that NATO itself would pursue this enlargement of belligerence agenda, given both the depth of economic and social problems in its own member states, as well as, you know, common challenges like natural disasters, uncontrolled immigration? Don't they have sort of more pressing issues to deal with?
Of course they do, but NATO is an extension of the U.S. foreign policy. So as long as the U.S., you know, their processes are okay, NATO has to follow. After all, why was NATO made in 1945? To keep Russia out, to keep Germany down, and to keep America in. So it hasn't changed. The Warsaw Pact collapsed and changed. Russia said they didn't want a new Cold War. They adopted the market economy. They were part of globalization, but the NATO agenda did not change and it remains the same.
You said that the NATO agenda will remain as it is as long as the United States is okay with that, but the Americans are no longer insulated from the consequences of their own foreign policy. I mean, if we look at the, you know, life quality metrics in the United States, they are getting down. The forecast for the, you know, future generations is even worse than it is right now. Plus, you have many unexpected problems. It looks like the nature itself in the form of hurricanes and droughts and everything else is sort of taking revenge on the Americans. So they have multiple challenges that they have to address, and the resource base is not getting bigger. So this is something that I don't understand from this, you know, self-interest perspective. Why would those elites still be interested in pouring money abroad rather than doing something at least to placate their own population, if not to make life better?
Absolutely correct. Two reasons. One is the fact that the elites are committed to their military-industrial complex, to their whole military-industrial congress and money corporate complex more than the people. They need the people only to vote them in, but people are beginning to realize. But the kind of soft power they exercise, one, and the kind of dollar, they keep printing more dollars for wars, and they do have inflation and things and debt. But ultimately, I think more and more people are realizing, and that is why they are banning more and more channels in the alternate media. That is why they are blaming, oh, everything is because of either the Russians or the Chinese or other countries. So that blame game. But I think more and more people are beginning to recognize it. So it has to come internally. Meanwhile, they continue to play the same game and maybe, you know, win some, lose some.
Now, Professor Chinoy, the ability to adapt swiftly and creatively to the changing circumstances around you is one of the main hallmarks of agile leadership. And I think we are observing that all around the world and many of the developing countries, but not so much in the West, Western ways of projecting its power and influence have become very rigid, very ironclad, very commanding, very uncompromising. What happened to Western ingenuity? Because we can all remember times when it was genuinely one of the engines of human progress.
Correct. And what's happened is that countries of the global South and those of the majority, the global majority, they have shifted. They have seen the way the wind is blowing. They have formed their own bodies now, like the BRICS, and that is why so many countries want to join it. And they have, I know India, for example, has a vested interest in multipolarity and BRICS. And you can see 30 countries want to join it. Other countries who are not part of it and who cannot join right away, they are choosing the path of neutrality, like ASEAN countries, the African countries, and Latin American countries. Everyone has seen it. So they're trying to save themselves from this kind of Western hegemonism, which is becoming very hypocritical, especially, you know, as this this heroic kind of resistance in Palestine that has really moved billions of people into realizing what the West really is, with all their discourse on human rights and liberal internationalism. And when it comes to brown people or other people outside them, they're dispensable.
You mentioned BRICS and other forms of organization internationally. And what I think BRICS is offering to its members is a very flexible alliance. It's not even an alliance. It's sort of a club of countries that come together, that discuss things, that pass some non-binding agreements. But there is a spirit of cooperation and sort of non-exploitative attitude to each other's problems, whereas the West still insists on ironclad uniformity for its own so-called allies. How long do you think this paradigm of sort of commanding the countries to submission can hold realistically?
Not very long, because the BRICS model attracts other countries. The Western NATO model is one with us or against us. A rule-based order, which is actually a force-based order. It's not rules. Those rules are double standards. They apply to, you know, their rules on based on the American national interest, not on our national interest. Whereas BRICS, as you said, is a platform. It works on consensus. It works on dialogue. It works on understanding of multiple poles. It works on respect to other countries.
And perhaps also empathy, you know, empathy for each other's developmental paths, which could be different and which could take different times to be accomplished.
Absolutely, because you can see that BRICS doesn't have one. They have a vision, but countries in BRICS can have their own strategies in dealing with the West. Just take Russia, China, India. All three have different ways of dealing with hegemony. They all say we are opposed to hegemony, but Russia is in direct conflict. China wants to take them on the economic finance issue. And India wants to leverage and engage with them and engage with the BRICS. And all three understand their positions, that you can be together and have difference.
That's amazing. And I think many other countries are perhaps taking inspiration from that. Now, Professor Chinoy, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to this discussion in a few moments. Stay tuned.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
Километров фронт лайн.
Ночью проснулись, блин. Прилетело, загорелось. Ты же что ж, извини, мама осталась без детей, без троих.
Noi non andiamo in Donbass a combattere. con le armi. Andiamo in Donbass a dimostrare al popolo del Donbass che l'Europa civile esiste. Noi che andiamo dal 2014 dimostriamo che nel 2014 l'Ucraina, aiutata dai nostri governi purtroppo, ha creato un colpo di Stato. E la propaganda del governo degli Stati Uniti entra nelle case e ci racconta che la Russia ha invaso l'Ucraina nel 2022. Nelle manifestazioni, spesso ora, si vede anche la bandiera della Russia e la bandiera di Donetsk e di Lugansk. A Madrid c'è una grossa comunità che partecipa alla carovana antifascista. Come dico sempre, andiamo in Donbass, incontriamo i vivi e i morti. Ti andiamo al cimitero, beviamo una vodka, cantiamo l'internazionale, perché è così che va.
Ancora una volta siamo qui.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Anuradha Chinoy, a professor emerita at Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. Now, Professor Chinoy, you know, as I was preparing for an interview with you, I also happened to be studying the dynamics of narcissistic personality disorder, and the similarities there are truly striking to me, because people of this kind, or groups of this kind, because this psychology can also be collective, they tend to have a very huge sense of entitlement. They use this divide and conquer or triangulation tactics. But what's most interesting to me is that they don't do that to create something of value, some, you know, common benefit. They only do that to ensure their own supply, both positive supply and negative supply, because they actually enjoy being, you know, in this, at the center of conflictual dynamics, because, you know, it gives them attention or a sense of self-importance. Do you think it's similar to the way the United States or the West more generally behaves on the international stage?
Absolutely. Now, let me just deconstruct very quickly in a minute their whole argument of exceptionalism. They say that the United States is exceptional, it's a greatest power, it's a greatest civilization. And where does this come from? It is actually an extension of the colonial mindset of getting rid of the indigenous populations. It goes back to that we are exceptional. Our civilization is more advanced, whereas it is not. Than anyone else, their non-acceptance of the other and building an entire narrative around it. You can see that wherever, in whether it's in Australia, especially in the United States, where they got rid of the entire native population. Why? Because we are exceptional, we are better, that this land should be ours, and inch by inch we get it anyway. So that continues now in a similar way. We are exceptional, so we don't have to follow rules. We don't have to follow international law, and you're either with us or against us. And depending on the state, if you're not with us, we can use force, or we can use our dollars, or you can be some kind of, you know, second-tier partner, or various other things. And the corporates and their ideology, everything is in sync, and the media. So it's a whole fantastic system, which is not easy to see through. So there are not many people, but now gradually in academia, we have, you know, this decolonization arguments, where especially a lot of women and feminists, et cetera, and critical thinkers in the global South are beginning to say that we need a decolonization framework to get out of this this kind of Eurocentric, American-centric paradigms and epistemologies.
You used the word fantastic, and I gather from the latest research into narcissism that this kind of psychology, this kind of mindset, is based a lot on wishful thinking and all kind of phantasmagorical, fantastical ideas. And what I find very interesting is that at the opposite end from grandiosity that they sort of exude, is not inferiority, but the lack of recognition of equality. So people of narcissistic mindset, they simply don't believe that others are their equals. And yet, both the United States and the West more generally is using this narrative of freedom, equality, diversity. Still to this day, they believe that they are the champions of freedom and equality. How was it possible for the world to be fooled for so long?
Well, because, you see, technologically, the Industrial Revolution, etc., took place in the West, and the East, which are very old civilizations. Russia is a very old civilization. I mean, America was not even formed when Crimea became part of Russia. So you can see these Johnny-come-latelys, but because they had some technology and they linked up with the colonial powers, they have also unilateral thinking. They think you have to go the same path. Everyone has to follow them. So our local civilizations, our local native indigenous ideas have been, you know, on top of them, all these Western ideas have formed as the best ones. And our local ideas have been submerged. They become subliminal. We've never been hegemonic. Which country in the global South has ever been hegemonic? And even now with BRICS, you can see it's not hegemonic. It is asking for pluralism. It's embedded in peaceful coexistence. It's embedded in the non-aligned movement. It's embedded in neutrality. It's embedded in giving a voice to the global South. So they are trying. It's just that they have so long been physically oppressed, and this materiality, which was dominated in the West with, you know, that they've used all this together for these collective oppressions, which are now, there is this process again of getting rid of these epistemologies. It will take time.
Now, you made the point in one of your article that it's pretty much obvious from U.S. policy documents that the United States is a parasitic power, an openly parasitic power, that it has a habit and almost an entitlement to use other nations to further its own agenda. But I'm not sure what that agenda is at this point, because the American populace is deeply divided. The Americans are very dissatisfied with the way their own country is run, regardless of whether they subscribe to Democratic or Republican ideology. So what do you think is ultimately the American agenda at this point, or the agenda of the American elites?
I think their agenda is to maintain the status quo. They enjoyed unipolarity from 1990 to 2022. By 2009, they started discovering that Russia has stabilized, that China is overtaking them in every way, except military force, perhaps, that India is a great emerging power with an expanding market. There are these Asian tigers, Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam. And then they started getting frantic that they have to maintain their unilateralism, their primacy, their hegemony. And they say it in document after every national security document has this thing that the U.S. has to be superior on land, sea, earth, space, satellite, everywhere.
But what does it give to ordinary Americans? I mean, do they pretend that this is in the interest of the American people?
They do, because they think that it's going to trickle down, which is not anymore. American wages have been stagnant for years. Look at what happened with the hurricane recently. I just saw that each of them got something like $750, whereas you're giving $18 billion to Ukraine and another $10 billion to Israel, and you're giving hundreds of trillions to the arms industry. And what kind of projections do they have? The chief of their naval staff says, oh, in 2027, we're going to have a war with China. Then yesterday I saw another statement, one of their big national security guys saying, oh, in 2030, Russia and US is going to have a war. These kind of ridiculous projections for which they start preparing and making it a threat so people get scared. This threat escalation and demonization, which keeps their population busy aside from their very brilliant films and, you know, entertainment, which they keep feeding so people don't think.
We are days away from the American presidential elections, in which I think identity politics has been taken to a whole new level, because you have these two very remarkable candidates, Donald Trump, whom his opponents often describe as a malignant narcissist, and yet he's, well, I think at least pretty... Well, pretty honest in the way he expresses his ideas. You can take an issue with his ideas, but he seems to be very genuine in the way he expresses them. And then you have Kamala Harris, who seems to stand for all the right things, but in a very pretentious, very shape-shifting, very sort of artificial way, or at least it's the way it comes across to me. What do you think about these current elections as a stage or as a phase in the identity politics that the Americans have practiced for so long, both at home and abroad?
I think, you know, you're right, Kamala Harris. The Democrats internally are a party of coalition of small groups, blacks and brown and Asian and Chinese and Catholics and Hindu and Muslim, etc. So they come together like that. But the way they have behaved the last 5 years, 4 or 5 years, of targeting all these small communities in their foreign policy, they may not have done it internally. You know, people are beginning to think, what are these people up to? As far as Trump is concerned, he always says he wants to get rid of the swamp, which is actually the permanent state of the US. So, but he appeals to the non-woke, middle America, Rust Belt. So there is this identity politics, but as far as foreign policy is concerned, I really don't know how much the swamp will continue to control them. I know Kamala Harris will be a front for the deep state. She doesn't seem to have any, she may be good for them internally, but at least for us for in foreign policy, it will be more of the same, if not worse. Donald Trump might take some new individual positions, but it depends on how much this, you know, in the last election, the deep state did hold him back. He's basically transactional, a businessman, and he can say anything he wants. But at least he's a bit more interesting to watch than Kamala Harris is for us as outsiders.
You have argued before that strategic autonomy is probably the best way to protect yourself from the American deep state and also to ensure your own development. And coincidentally, that's also one of the main recommendations to the survivors of narcissistic abuse, because at the root of this dynamic, both psychological and I assume geopolitical, is the outsourcing of your decision-making and your security to a powerful or glorious other. What does it take in this day and age to ensure your strategic autonomy as a country, especially if you are not a giant like India or Russia, but a relatively small or middle-sized nation?
Well, look, one is to have social cohesion and to include others in your governance structure, because you can see what happened in Bangladesh and in Pakistan. They did try to have strategic autonomy. They, you know, especially Bangladesh, she had links with China, with India. She had Russia nuclear power plants. And the Americans were saying no, no, no to all of this very quietly. They were building up the NGOs. And then because she had problems with the opposition, they boycotted the election, even though she was popular and she'd stabilized Bangladesh. But when this
You mean the former prime minister, right?
The former prime minister of Bangladesh. As soon as a student movement started, what happened? You know, the opposition and the Americans got activated and they were able to do a regime change. You know, similarly in smaller countries. So to have strategic autonomy, you need to have a stable social cohesion within, even if you have poverty and debt, as long as you take your entire people together so they don't become the agents for the Americans, especially because Russia, China don't intervene in domestic affairs, not as India. They don't believe in that. Generally, they are called, you know, sometimes some countries call India a regional hegemon, but we don't really intervene in anyone else's elections. So that is why these states have to resist this. They can get together with local organizations like ASEAN. It's not easy to intervene with the ASEAN states now because they have ASEAN, they have collective thinking. You have a country like Vietnam, which says a three no's in their constitution, no to joining any military alliance, no to joining any group which is in a military war with one or the other, you know, and no to any bases within. So countries have to do that.
Yeah, staying true to yourself is sometimes very challenging, but ultimately it's the only thing that you can do. I mean, that's what we live for, both on individual and I assume collective level as well. Professor Chinoy, thank you very much for being with us today. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.